Hello and welcome to the Label Sessions Presents podcast. Label Sessions is the world's leading innovation expert network. In this series, you will meet some of the most interesting leaders anywhere, from across the worlds of business, design, tech, culture, and sustainability, all signed to the Label Sessions roster. To find out more about our work, helping brands and institutions around the world take on their big challenges for the future, head to labelsessions.com to find out more. For now, enjoy the podcast.
Lou, thank you so much for taking time to sit down and talk to me. I really appreciate it. I'd love just to kick us off with a little bit of an intro to you, your work, and the sort of backstory that gets you to where you are today.
Well, I mean, as you can see, there's going to be a lot of backstory, so let me not hog up all the time by telling you. But generally speaking, I started my career working in a bank. And you can imagine, if you're an entrepreneur, that's like strangling somebody. But the good part about it was that I did learn a lot about fiscal responsibility, the way corporates work, and just the corporate attitude. And it's done me well over the years. But as I said, worked in a bank for 11 years before I left. And I have had quite a diverse career, I guess. In the beginning, I was a DJ. So I was a club DJ, and so I worked in the bank and I worked as a club DJ at the same time. But that was another very interesting, and it really did me well because I got to learn how to read people, how to motivate people. I mean, it was similarly to get people on the dance floor, get them off to drink, getting them back on, etc. It's a way of politely addressing a conversation in a way that you can manipulate the end result. So that was interesting. But where it all started was I started a group of computer stores. So that got me involved in technology quite early on. So that's my background in the technology. And then I was headhunted by an American firm to, by the way, I'm from Perth, Western Australia. Okay, so I was headhunted by an American company to start the Sydney operations of a rather large company. And there I did pretty well. I used my traits and, you know, what I'd learned in the rest of my career to really understand how to speak to corporates and then be a translator. Either the translator was translating directions to actions or translating needs to wants or vice versa. And by doing that, I was able to build the company quite quickly. Where I was asked to do head up the European operations, of which I said no because we had a child. So I don't know where your listeners are from or their age group or whatever, but when you have children, things change. And so you put aside some of the aspirations to get into the perspirations. But it's in the end, I did have the opportunity. When I went back to Perth, I started a technology marketing company, and thankfully I did really, really well. I was able to take some foreign corporates and alert them to how the at that stage the very early startup community operated, and then again I did my translation in what the corporates needed into something that the startups could really deliver. And obverse of that was that the startups always have so much energy, et cetera, but you need to temper that down to ensure that the corporates can understand and ingest whatever it is you're trying to tell them. But from there, I was CEO, several CEOs in the US and back in Australia, a CEO of a network monitoring company, which I took to the United States, had it VC funded. Eventually, we sold it to IBM. So an inordinate amount of expertise came from there, from making a hell of a lot of mistakes. And they weren't just the only ones. I made a lot of mistakes during this period, during my career. And I guess my ambition is always to ensure that those mistakes aren't replicated by my clients or mentees or the corporates that would hire me to help them integrate technology or develop products. So along the way, I had eight of my own startups, which one was really stellar. Two were average, one got my money back, and the other ones were a disaster. So, you know, as I tell my mentees, your best mentor is one who's really screwed it up several times. And that's why I believe so much in the way that I handle things. And luckily, I am able to portray that failure is part of the value of success. So that's where I am at the moment. I help CEOs, one in an aviation company, so, you know, holding 200 people under his belt. Another one is a startup in the crypto world. Another one is a popsicle creator. So I've done a lot of it. And my ambition, as I said, is to impart the knowledge that I've managed to accumulate into something that is of value to other people.
Brilliant. And I'd love to delve into that backstory a little bit more. So one of the things I'm always fascinated when I hear about, you know, Eight Times Founder, a lot of different sort of chapters of your life, is when you, do you see those as like individual sort of eras, so to speak, or do you see them as all interconnected and sort of interwoven and sort of a natural progression of how you would have done things?
Look, you know, people say, would you have done it again? Yes, I would have done it again, but I wouldn't have made the mistakes. The difference between being able to create a successful company, in which now I understand and I say to people takes 7 years, it's because those 7 years are filled not only with your ambition and your luck and all that. It takes time. It takes time. And like people say to me, your experience, but, you know, I also know an experienced guy who's been doing it for 5 years. Well, I say, well, I've been doing it for 25 years, and you can't shortcut time. So time is what gives you all of the elements that come together to make a successful company. However, if you could delete the mistakes you made, obviously that time can be compressed, delete all the bad times, and you've got an end result much quicker. So in answer to your question, I think you have to go through them. But if I'd only had someone to help me in those early stages when I was making ridiculous errors and errors of judgment, errors of direction, it would have been so much easier. And that's why I say to people, get help. It's a badge of mistakes are a badge of honor, but you don't need to have those badges. You don't. You can go along with someone. And I call myself, in other instances, a wingman. So I come along with, I don't know, it's a CEO, COO, or even CMO. I've done all those three. And sit alongside them to discuss individual situations that lead to some sort of ending that they're looking for. It's a lot easier than just, you know, 1 hour, hello, what did you do last week? And this is what I suggest. That it can't really be done that way. You really need time to sit down next to somebody.
No, that's great. And that sort of prompts me to push into what it is that you're building now. And what is it about the challenge of what you're working on now that drives you to do it after having all these experiences and, you know, talking about, you know, taking care of CEOs, as you were mentioning before?
What drives me to it is still, I guess, the thrill of the hunt. It's the thrill of it all. The thrill of being able to sit down at a table, say, let's do that, and then rolling it out and seeing you get to the next step. And then getting to that step and go, okay, most of that we did right, let's build on that. And from building from a nothing, from an idea, from a kernel of an idea to something you can roll out, many iterations of course, and then hopefully come out with a solution that makes people proud, the startup or the corporation. Maybe they've got an open innovation idea. When you get to the end of it and you see the happy faces, that's something that reminds me of why it is I do this, even though, you know, I've done it so many times. I think it's the same as acting. Well, you go on acting and you're there because someone will clap at the end. I think, you know, in the end, be really basic about it. That's what it is. The other side of that is that every time I work with either a corporate or a startup, I throw myself into it. So I learn as much as I can about the industry they're in. At the moment, aviation industry, that's a difficult one. It's taking time. But the crypto trading, that was something I always avoided because it comes with this, you know, this feeling of something that's not so secure. But having understood it, now I can give true advice and advice that makes sense to the person that's hearing it, not just generalize. And some people call me a generalist. I guess if you can reimagine yourself many times, then that becomes the why you're a generalist. But in essence, it's the tools that I've developed that really help me get to the end of any opportunity that's put in front of me.
And that leads in really well to thinking of you as leader. You've obviously answered a little bit of it there. What is it that makes you tick? Do you always sort of see yourself as a little bit of a generalist, or do you have processes that you go through when you take on a new challenges, or are you a little bit more trusty gut, more intuitive?
In the early days of startups, people were asked to build business plans. But I have a business plan. Tell me about the business plan so that I can poke holes in it. Well, you can do all the bleeping you want, but that's just bullshit, because you cannot create a company from nothing and have a business plan on how you're going to succeed. All you can do is you can lay out what your vision is, add resources to it, get some investment, put the people there, and then go forward. And you have to pivot all the way. So the question that you asked me is, do you have these processes? Do you have all these things? It's a logical question. I get asked a lot. But I cannot say that I look back on my notes, which obviously I take a lot of, when we have especially earlier meetings with either mentees or corporates. But I never really look back at them, because I take the feeling that I got from that task, and then I put that feeling over the top of the next task. And by doing that, you are sort of jumping ahead. I mean, how did I get to that feeling? Because that happened. Okay, I'm already there now. So I already know what happened and how I handle that. So I look at it a little bit differently. Some people said to me, well, why don't you write sort of a book about it? But you can't write a book about feelings, because everyone's is individual. You can write ideas and you know, this is the first step and that's the third step, etc. But it doesn't help everybody. You know, I've made a living out of also telling people when don't do it. You know, corporate, don't go down that path, or don't take that step. And most of the time they look at me very strangely, because they've been asked to accelerate whatever the procedures they were doing, or to get to an end result. And I can see that there's going to be a hell of a lot of problems if they continue in that manner. So my first answer to my first response is, given experience and experience of others that, you know, my peers who I'm collected over many years, corporates that I can talk to, etc., on having some sort of discussion about this, I don't think it's a right thing to do. So do I have a way of doing things? I do, but it's very difficult to share, because it does come from the inside.
No, that's great, actually. It's a very interesting sort of thing that you brought up there about notes versus feelings, because I feel like you're right on the notes front. It's sort of the equivalent of like people taking videos at a gig, and it's like, how often do you go back and actually watch that?
Isn't that exactly right? And you see them all with their mobile phones up there, all talking, and, you know, this one's got his iPad out as well. I don't know, whatever. It's to me that they are, that's the same thing as I was trying to express it. Obviously, I didn't do that very well. But when I take minutes at meetings, if you like, myself, I miss a lot of it, because I'm not watching the way that people are delivering these phrases or these questions. And that's the most important part. And as I learned, being a DJ, you're working the crowd all the time. You're looking to see the reaction to this word, that word. And so taking notes is good as far as having a record in case anybody asks, but it's not necessarily going to be the thing that sticks in your mind. Because after all, watching something sticks in your mind much more than just having to write about it. And once you learn what it is you're looking for, then you're building these, as I said, these feelings around the conversations that you can short circuit into something that makes value back for the customer.
I know that you talked about this a little bit before. It's probably a little bit of an obvious question, to be fair, but what advice would you give to your younger self from that sort of, from the, you know, the leadership perspective? And is it, other than just, you know, don't make those mistakes that you already know that you did. You know, hindsight's 20/20, but.
Okay, I do have a couple of those, because they come up all the time. if you're a department manager and you've been given a task, or you're a founder and you've got a startup, or you're even a corporation, you're rolling out a product. It's never your baby. Because if you keep thinking of it as your baby, you'll do everything to protect it when it really is sometimes better to let it go, either to let it grow or to let it go. Because if you bring emotion into the notion of what you should be doing, you may be clouding your judgment. And that is a one that even every day I have to think about, okay, this is important, but this is not life-changing. I can let it go. And it's useful for two things. One is that, which is my baby. But the other way of thinking is when the downsides come, and there are so many downsides, no matter where you work or where your life leads you, if you think of all those, if you dwell on those downsides, I'll give you an example. If you dwell on them, your history really, because you're there and you need to be there. And it happened to me. And that's why I've learned it. I was the CEO of a company, also in the United States. And I was doing everything that got us to that point, and you know, things were going well, et cetera, in my mind. And then I was called out to an extraordinary board meeting, thinking, wow, some of the opportunities come up. And basically I was told, that's it. You're not CEO anymore. We're going to put somebody else in this place. And so you can imagine. Now, that happened early in my career, and lucky it did, because then I realized that the tenure of CEO is as good as you can make it any one time, and you have to have a broader picture than what's only in your heart. You've got to be thinking about the benefit for the investors, for the partners, for the crew, and for yourself. And if you don't involve yourself in the big picture, then you're going down a path which may not necessarily be one that's of benefit to everybody. So there you go. There's another reason why, you've got to be aware. That's probably a good one word. Be aware all the time. Be looking at what you're doing from another perspective so that you can see how not only how you're doing, but how it's interacting with other people that you don't necessarily talk to, but things that you do react with other people. It might be another department. It might be another head of a partnership that you're affecting. So do the 100-foot look down upon what you're doing and get a better perspective of it.
I'd love to look forward now and think about what it is that you're excited about, in terms of like opportunities that are emerging or challenges in recent years that will be important for your work now or upcoming. It doesn't have to be AI, obviously, because that's the big thing that everybody talks about.
look, things come and go, and I've seen it all, from multimedia to any other number of things that are just the future. They're all part of where we're going. They're not where we're going. So AI is important, and I use it in many aspects of the day. If you want to be an AI expert, it would be like being an Excel expert. Well, okay, you want to be Excel, well, go ahead, but that's not the scope that I'm looking at. Opportunities for me is to become involved with a really intelligent corporation. One that realizes advancement can be done with the help of startups or with ex-founders, etc. And I'm looking to be able to take all the resources that would be made available to me and short-circuit the problems that they have and come out with solutions. And there's solutions that, to a startup, it's about, we're going to be going for another 6 months. But to a corporation, that could raise their share price in an instant. So, I've done my share of big ones and little ones. And now I'm looking more at, making some big home runs, being a part of some big home runs.
When you look around the sort of industry that you're in, and where is it that you see, what are those opportunities? What are those big sort of home runs that you think, is there any particular things that you can, not necessarily predict, but sort of foresee that you think will be on the cards?
There's going to be a huge transition in the way media is delivered. Sure, at the moment, people say streaming, but yet there is so much more to go with it. I'll give you an example of why I'm excited about that. Years ago, I was employed by EMI, and Universal Music to look into digital rights management. And those days, a DRM. In those days, they were being canned from MP3s, were being played all over the place, and they wanted to get some money out of it. So their question to me and to my team was, okay, let's employ some smart people to create some digital rights management so people can't play these things. So, I mean, the direction was the action, you know, the direction was, can we do this to stop people from taking money out of our pockets? But the action was, well, instead of taking it out of your pockets, maybe we can put some of it back into your pockets. So that was the very early days of thinking, not about digital rights management, but controlling the streaming of music and how the streaming music could go back and the revenue could be retained by the labels. So the same thing is now with television. You think about it, podcasters like us, we have limited budgets. I have my own video studio, a small one, and I know that I can only do this much and I can only do that much. I don't have this facility. I don't have the other one. But the big guys, they have everything. Outside broadcasts, they have huge studios, they have all the equipment, but they're not getting involved in where the media is being ingested. There's a it's disparate between TV and podcasting, for instance, or TV and streaming services. There's got to be somewhere where we've got to come back to the way that we using AI or whatever tool you want, I don't care what it is, when you say to me, my name is Josh, I do this, and blah, 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 my wife does that, our kids are this, no problem. And the streaming comes to you that means something to you, is of value to you. And the institutional ads that are included are ones that make sense to you. So it is ad-based, but you welcome the ads because it's either some thing that you want, aspire to, or you enjoy. But in the end, you're not lurking and searching through all the thousands of streaming platforms to try to find something that you like. It will be delivered to you that makes sense to you. So, and I was, as I said, I was involved in this very, very early days where we had the opportunity to buy a lot of old content and then stream it. This was only one-to-one. It wasn't broadcast. That was important. But at that time, the people that held the content thought that television was going to be the only way. But now it's changed. So people who have the content are willing to explore different ways of delivering it. And certainly the networks need this new way of thinking. And I'd be so happy to work in an environment where we could be talking about the future of media and how it is ingested.
It's interesting that it has a bit of a cross-section between music and television, but a lot of issues with DRM and a lot of things come down to, it's a matter of convenience, right? And it's quite cyclical in how these things come to be because, you know, Spotify boomed, it was seen as the new herald, and now it's sort of a little bit tired. It's still obviously the king of its platform, but it's sort of more being seen in you know, video streaming, for example, because, like, it's coming back to being cable again because there's a lot of American companies saying, we'll bundle all these channels together for one lower price. It's like, isn't it just what we just got away from in terms of, you know, terrestrial television? So I think that it's interesting about how the next few will come from a factor of convenience, because obviously convenience is the big barrier against piracy, because I find that a lot of people don't pirate things, so a lot of people don't choose to consume things because it's necessarily bad. It all comes down to the experience more so than, you know.
You're quite right. You know, there's a saying, I don't remember who said it, and you might think it has nothing to do with what we're talking about, but it is true. Wealthy people are not like us. Okay, so what that tells you is that you can't look at someone and say, I can do that. Look, that's how it's done. I'll do it. It's just not like that. Wealthy people are different from us. And so the streaming companies are different from the networks. They're different from cable TV. And people are different to each other. So what is value to you? It's value to you. It's something that makes it enjoyable to be interacting with. So this personalization has to be the key, where in the end, really, you don't care where it's coming from. So that's all that inconvenience and then gone. Someone will deliver it to you easily to accept, and it will be given to you in a way that's of value to you, not only because you like it, but what time of day is it? What did you buy last that has changed your mind about this advert that will be coming? This kind of, they're trying to do it now, of course, but it's going to disappear with cookies. And of course, cookies are going to be at an end. We know that, third-party cookies. So all the companies that have this personal or what do they call it now? First-party data. So Josh, first-party data to you could be your cellular company knows what time you make phone calls, who you're calling. They know all that kind of stuff because it's first-party data. And then there's a watch company that knows when you bought the watch, when you put a new face on it. So all this first-party data is out there, but nobody's talking to each other because they're all keeping it to themselves. So we're not able to build big personas of some people because the data is kept in different vaults, let's put it this way. So what's needed is an acceptable way of sharing first-party data so that it is still anonymous. However, that first-party data about Josh with all of those things goes to two things. One is to provide them entertainment the way they want to see it. That's important, given your lifestyle, your age and all that. And the other one is to provide you with advertising that you are wanting. And I'll give you an example. I've got a startup idea about this, but think about the post office in reverse. You go to the post box and you take something out of the box, right? But think about it that now you're on the other side of the post box. You're in there and you see all these boxes in there. On the other side, the boxes are televisions, cars, trips, schools. And on your side, you're just looking at the ones that you want. You're looking at cars. Oh, my God, there's something in the car box. I read it. I like it. I buy a car. I close that. I'm not looking at the car box anymore. That's not interest to me. So what you're doing is there's a filter there. That is a real-world filter. And that filter can be accumulation of this first-party data in a delicate way of controlling it, obviously, with GDPR and responsible, so that it's anonymized. So when Josh sits down on the television, you're not going to see another car ad. Why would you see another car ad? You just paid 40 grand for your car. So that's part of what I think will come in the future as far as personalization of the media and the way that you eat it.
Look, that's great. That's something that really ties me into our last question. And it's a question that we ask everybody. So don't be too alarmed. But it's on a scale of 1 to 10, 10 being the most, Lou, how weird are you?
Well, you know, when I look in the mirror, I go, you're weird. And I say that because I hear it from other people. They wonder why do I go down the path of heartache on new projects? And why am I excited when somebody has some innovation? That when I was growing up, they called me the gadget guy because I just wanted to have everything and I wanted to learn how everything worked. And it is really tiring and I will work nonstop, but then something will happen and then I just have to go to sleep for a day because I just can't keep up the energy. So a lot of people think I'm weird that way. Why do I take risks, even if it's for other people? And how is it that I have so much energy? Where does it come from? So they're the two weird facts about me.
Brilliant. That's everything I have for you today, Lou. I really appreciate your time, but it's been fantastic. Thank you so much.
You're very welcome, Josh. Look forward to any time talking to you, no matter where we are.
As we close out another episode, make sure to like, subscribe, and follow us on our social channels. Want to access Label Sessions for your brand? Whether you want to build new products, access world-class mentors for your team, or reinvent the way you attract talent into your business, visit Label Sessions to find out more.